A new memorial unearths America's legacy of lynching.
The people who were lynched have never been released from that until now, because we've never identified them en masse.
A monument testifies to the country's history of racial terror with hopes of recovery and reconciliation. And a descendant of two lynching victims tells her family story.
He was in a position where there was shooting and burning at the same time. He said to his wife, "We may as well die running as standing still."
Also, your calls on how the legacy of lynching resonates today.
Lynching has always been a deterrent to keep the African American population in fear so that there was no pursuit of equality or justice.
That story and a whole lot more. This is The Takeaway for Thursday, April 26th, 2018. In Lake City, South Carolina, in 1898, an African-American man named Frazier Baker was appointed postmaster by President William McKinley. Baker traveled to Lake City with his wife and his six children. Dr. Faustina Baker is Frazier's grandniece, and she says that the white residents of the town lashed out with violence, angry that a black man had been appointed postmaster.
Once Frazier got to his post, the first thing that happened was he was shot, but not fatally or seriously wounded, while leaving the post office one evening. And the second situation was the post office where he was assigned was demolished by fire. After that time, it was necessary for him to find another location. So he got assistance from a black United Methodist church, and it was a one room, and he divided that property for living purposes as well as the postal services that he provided to the Lake City inhabitants.
But not long after, a mob of white people from the town showed up to the Baker's new home.
They came to the home about 1 a.m. The house was quiet. Everyone was asleep. And the eldest child, Rosa, said that she was awakened by the roaring of the fire. And then, as she jumped up, her father, Frazier, followed, and he realized that he was in a position where there was shooting and burning at the same time. He said to his wife, "We may as well die running as standing still." So she grabbed Julia in her arms, a 23-month-old, and they headed for the door. They shot Frazier first. He fell. And after that, the mob continued to shoot into the house, and Lavinia, the wife, and the five children escaped.
There was a trial for the murder of Frazier Baker and his infant daughter, Julia, but no one was found guilty. Dr. Faustina Baker says that the history of their lynching is still ingrained in Lake City's DNA.
I've looked at the surnames of the persons that were listed in the mob, and there are many names in the Lake City area that still reside there. But the interesting thing is, no one seems to know anything about the Frazier Baker story. If you tell them, they say, "I never heard that. Frazier Baker gave up his life working for the federal government, the 21 days in February of 1898 where he worked, and they never received any pension for the wife and the five children." There were other things going on in the country at that time that the president was very lucrative in giving to the community. But when it came to Frazier Baker, there was just no recognition at all, as though he never existed.
Frazier Baker and his daughter Julia are two of more than 4,400 Black Americans who are known to be the victims of racially motivated lynchings in this country. And many of their descendants share Dr. Baker's feelings. With little official recognition, it feels like they never existed. I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway.
Barren, strange fruits. Blood on the leaves. Blood at the roots. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze.
We begin at the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. It's a new monument opening today in Montgomery, Alabama, to commemorate the victims of lynching in America. One central piece of that commemoration is art.
My name is Dana King. I'm a sculptor based in Oakland, California, and the artist who created Guided by Justice for the Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama.
Dana King's sculpture of three women sits just outside the memorial. The heavy brown monoliths of the pavilion hang nearby as the women walk past on their way to somewhere else.
These women represent the women who walked during the Montgomery bus boycott. They walked every day, rain, shine, super hot in the summertime in Montgomery, and cold, actually bone-chilling cold in the wintertime. And they did it every day. I think my sculpture is like a trinity of quiet activism. These women shut down the bus company. Actually, all the walkers shut down the bus company. And they were unified in a way that I don't know that we can be unified today, which makes me sad. But hopefully this sculpture will inspire people with the understanding of what people went through and the sacrifices they made. As simple as not taking the bus was a huge sacrifice because they took the bus everywhere, to the doctor's office, to work, to the grocery store, to church. And these people said, no, we're done. We've had enough. And that changed the direction of the civil rights movement back in 1955. So these women are walking. One is going to the doctor. She's pregnant. And one is a teacher off to teach the babies. And one is a grandmother off to take care of the babies. They're all independent women. But they're unified in this goal. And the elderly woman is my great-grandmother, who was enslaved. Our family has one photograph of her. The teacher is my Aunt Tiny, who was a teacher and a principal in the segregated South. And the pregnant woman is a very special woman who's carrying a very special baby. And they're off in their quiet way to stop injustice.
I noticed that as these three women walk, the grandmother, the older woman, she's in the lead. She's first.
Yes, as well she should be, because those of us who are African-American are connected to slavery in some way. And mine is direct. And it was important for me to honor that time in American history. She's our elder, and we should revere them. And so she should lead the way.
The other person depicted as the teacher, standing just a little bit behind, you said, is your aunt, right? A teacher in the segregated South.
Tiny. She's not a tiny woman. But that's the way with nicknames, right? But she was a proper woman. She made her own clothing. I never saw my Aunt Tiny without a dress on. I never saw her in pants. And she was a fierce advocate for education. The activism, that quiet activism of all those women, is we give birth to the children, we teach the children who they are and where they come from and how they need to lead. And we take care of them. We nurture them. We love them. Yes, we work and quietly go about our lives, but our activism is directly attached to the children and the next generation. because where we come from is just in our DNA. Generation through generation through generation, we are attached to our history.
The women in your sculpture, which is just outside of the memorial itself, sort of alongside it on a path, they're walking by the lynched people represented in that memorial, or walking away from them or alongside them, I'm not sure. And I wonder how you view the topography of how this is laid out. The women in your work, in their relation to the many thousands of people represented having been lynched in the American South.
Montgomery itself is, it's the cradle of the Confederacy, and it's this iconic civil rights city where modern civil rights took off from the bus boycott. And the people who were lynched, from my point of view, have never been released from that until now, because we've never identified them en masse. You might come across a story here and there, but to see physically the embodiment of 4,400 people is overwhelming. So these are our ghosts, and we've been walking by our ghosts forever. But now those ghosts, in seeing their names and speaking their names, are released. They're free. That's the juxtaposition for me, is that we all have been walking by our ghosts. And whether we recognized it or not, didn't matter. It just was. It is. And these women and men and children who walked during the boycott worked to release them.
How's that process going in your view, Dana? I mean, the women depicted in your work, the memorial itself, are all part of our collective reckoning with our history. Of course, the memorials and the statues are the least important part of that. The most important part is the actual learning and the actual progress, right? The actual reckoning. How's that part going in your view?
It's slow. But until now, it's been an individualized learning. And now we can talk about this. Now we have proof, we have evidence. Not that we didn't before, but now it's been collected. This proprietary information is collected, and it's located in one space. And there's no denying the impact of it. There's no denying the power of it and the influence of it. And now we can talk about it. Now we have to talk about it. We can't go backwards from here. We can only move forward. And I think that that's exactly what this memorial does. It helps us. It propels us forward. And it's a hard, hard learning. it's a soulful learning. It's a heartbreaking learning. But it's a learning that we have to undertake nonetheless.
Dana King is a sculptor and the creator of Guided by Justice, just one part of the Memorial for Peace and Justice. Dana King, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Todd.
My name is Damani, calling from Brooklyn. Through generations, as an African American, my parents and their parents were all from the South, and generation after generation, lynching has always been a deterrent to keep the African-American population and community as a whole in fear, so that there was no pursuit of equality or justice. I'm happy that finally there is a memorial that's going up to embrace those lives that were lost through this heinous act of hatred.
The National Memorial for Peace and Justice opens today in Montgomery, Alabama. You can visit thetakeaway.org to see photos of the monument and for information on how to visit.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. black body swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and teachers in Arizona are joining the growing list today of public educators going on strike. And we followed strikes in West Virginia, in Oklahoma, and Kentucky. Now, Arizona teachers say they're walking out despite some concessions from the state's Republican governor. Nora Carvelis teaches music education at Littleton Elementary School in Avondale, Arizona, right outside Phoenix, and he's participating in today's walkout. Noah, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I guess it's Mr. Carvelis to the kids, right?
Yeah, Mr. K. Mr. Carvelis is too hard, so we just do Mr. K.
Mr. K, look, we heard last week that the governor had offered to meet teachers' demands for a 20% pay increase. So why are you still walking out?
Yeah, you know, he really didn't meet that demand because here's the main issue. It doesn't have a sustainable funding source. So without funding for this proposal that he put forward, it's really an empty promise. And we don't trust that empty promise. And now we're looking and this proposal still hasn't materialized to any sort of legislature or funding. And again, we just have an empty promise here right now. And we're in a state of crisis.
Now, one of the issues that legislators in Arizona have brought up is how to pay, not only for the 20% pay increase, but for the other money that you all are looking for. They have raised the prospect that they can come up with this money if they cut social services, if they cut Medicaid, health care for poor people. How does the balance work out in your calculation here?
You know, I think we have to look at the things that we've cut for decades now, and those are corporate tax rates. We're losing hundreds of millions of dollars every single year because of the way that we've slashed taxes on corporations. So that's where I look right away. We have corporations last year who paid $600 million less in taxes than they did in 2007, and that's unacceptable.
Noah, Mr. K, a lot of schools, when funding goes short, they cut programs like yours. They cut art. They cut music. Tell me about your classroom and what the lack of funding has meant either to your program or to the programs of your colleagues at other schools.
Yeah, I'm lucky at my school that they really prioritize the arts, but still it's nothing like what it looks like to prioritize the arts in, say, Illinois or New York. I mean, I have like 7 keyboards in my room, a couple xylophones. And that's really it. And we try to make do with the best we can. We got a couple more guitars this year. And like I said, that's lucky. That's a good situation in terms of a music classroom. Most places, they're lucky to just have, you know, enough chairs in the room. And that's the reality here in Arizona. It's difficult. And when you're operating with a $1.1 billion deficit, and which we are, every single aspect of the school is hurt by that. Every single aspect of your daily life as a student is affected by that, because that's an incredible amount of money that's just missing now since 2008.
So then what would success look like here in the final analysis? I don't know that the Republican legislature is going to raise taxes on corporations. I mean, I get the accounting that you're doing. What does success look like to you?
You know, we put out 5 demands. We need to see movement on those 5 demands, because those came from us as educators saying, this is what we do. We are in the classroom every day. If you want to make a difference, you meet these 5 demands. And if the legislature will not meet those, we're going to continue to fight and we're going to find a way to meet those. And if it means doing it ourselves some way, we'll do that.
And before we let you go, Noah, parents, what are they saying? They tend to be supportive at the beginning of a strike and then they get tired if the kids are home for a week.
There's a lot of support right now. We've done a lot of walk-ins to build community support before school, walking through the school with the parents saying, look, this is why we're doing this. And they understand one thing. We're fighting for the kids in this, and we're fighting for their kids, and we're fighting for our state. And that's understood throughout the state right now, and there's a ton of support for this action.
Noah Carvelis teaches music education at Littleton Elementary outside of Phoenix in Avondale, Arizona. Mr. K, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go from Arizona to Colorado now, where teachers in that state are planning to walk out on Friday to protest education funding and low teacher salaries in their state. But two lawmakers in Colorado have come up with a controversial answer to this potential strike. Make it illegal. Senate Bill 264 is the bill titled Prohibit Public School Teacher Strikes. It was introduced last week, and it blocks public school teachers and organizers from directly or indirectly participating in a strike against any public school employer. Now, penalties include fines or even jail time. Now, this bill might be more of a statement than a probable law, but it gives a sense of the acrimony between teachers and some legislators in Colorado. Colorado State Senator Kevin Lundberg wasn't involved in that bill, but he does know about education funding in Colorado. He represents the 15th District in the Colorado Senate. That's Larimer County, just north of Denver. And he's also the Republican chair of the Colorado Senate Appropriations Committee. Senator Lundberg, thanks for being here.
Well, it's great being with you, Todd.
Well, Senator, Colorado is low on the list of education funding in the United States, 46th. In average teacher pay, spending $2,500 less per student than the national average. How did Colorado get so low on the list?
Well, first of all, I would question those numbers because there are a variety of ways of actually counting how we're spending things. I mean, I hear we're 47th, I think you said there, in teacher salaries, but I've also heard a whole lot of other different factors. Bear this in mind, that local school districts actually set the salary levels. And when you look at overall funding for public schools here in Colorado, we're somewhere in the the mid-range of funding for education.
So Colorado, like so many other states, is in the midst of a broader budget negotiation. Education has to be a huge part of that in Colorado, I'm sure. Senator, where is this going? Teachers are threatening to walk out on Friday. Is there breathing room in the budget for more money for schools and for teacher pay?
Well, actually, we just completed the budget for next year, and the governor recommended that we add another $100 million to our basic formula for education, and I'm on the Joint Budget Committee as well, and we decided that we would make that $150 million above and beyond what we were planning initially. The walkout scheduled for tomorrow on Friday is, you might say, just a general statement that they're making, and I think it's quite appropriate for people to come down and appeal to the legislature directly. We have groups almost every day doing that, but it's really not going to change the mix or the formula that we have, because we have only so much money to work with.
Well, Senator, I mentioned this bill 264, the Prohibit Public School Teacher Strikes bill. What do you make of it? Is it likely to become law, or is it just a swipe by some of your colleagues at teachers who might strike?
Well, given the reality that Colorado has a mixed legislature, the Republicans are in charge in the Senate and the Democrats are in charge in the House, a lot of bills do come through that are more statement bills than real public policy changes. I will be voting for that bill, but not because of the issues that we'll see today, but because I believe that education is one of those services provided by the government that really are essential services, and there is a real big loser when you have a teacher strike of any duration. Now, 1 or 2 days, I don't think it makes a big difference, but if you have 1 or 2 weeks, this can throw a student's educational progress really off track permanently. I actually experienced that myself as a student, well, it was about 50 years ago to be precise, but the Denver Public Schools decided to go on strike for a couple of weeks. And that was the end of my math track, because, you know, you either sank or swam. And in that case, I sank when it came to the making it through trigonometry.
Senator, I went to Denver Public Schools, too, maybe not at the same time you did. But I remember a lot of my teachers from Park Hill Elementary. Jail time is included in this bill for a strike. That seems excessive.
Well, I suspect that is a strong statement there, but again, it is a statement, not something that I would expect to see public policy.
Senator Kevin Lundberg is a Republican. He's chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee in Colorado. Senator, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's been great to be with you.
Joseph James DeAngelo has been called a lot of things by law enforcement, He's been called the East Side Rapist. He's been called the Visalia Ransacker, the original Night Stalker, and the Golden State Killer. Today, it's our pleasure to call him defendant.
After nearly four decades, an infamous murder mystery may be coming to an end in Sacramento, California. Throughout the 70s and 80s, a man known as the Golden State Killer and other names brutally raped and murdered and robbed in communities up and down California, terrorizing that state. But the serial killer eluded law enforcement for decades, apparently until Wednesday. Alec Emsley is criminal justice reporter with KQED in San Francisco. He's been covering this story. Alex, welcome.
Hey, howdy.
Alex, there was a press conference with local and federal law enforcement in Sacramento yesterday. Let me play you off the top here, Sacramento DA Anne-Marie Schubert, talking about this caller. Listen.
We all knew, as part of this team, that we were looking for a needle in a haystack. But we also all knew that the needle was there. In the last 6 days, and I emphasize the last 6 days, that passion, that persistence, and the knowledge finally came to an answer in this building behind us here, our crime lab.
Well, Alex, why do investigators believe that Joseph James DeAngelo is the person who raped and killed so many people in California in the 70s and 80s, and how was he caught?
Well, so much about this case relies on the advent and propagation of DNA forensic science. These crimes occurred throughout the state of California, from north to south, and initially they weren't thought to have been related. And it was only through DNA testing that came about really, you know, about a decade after the last murder that is attributed to this killer occurred, that you know, investigators started to put these pieces together and realize that all of these crimes likely had the same perpetrator.
And do we know how they pinned it on DeAngelo now? Did he give DNA? Was he arrested? How did that happen?
That is still a little bit unclear. And you know, we're told by DA Schubert, as well as other law enforcement officials, that that's going to come out in as they, you know, move to file charges and this case moves toward trial. Basically, they had an unknown profile of a suspect, a DNA profile, and it's unclear how that then turned to focus on this suspect. But once they did, once they thought, hey, maybe this is the guy, then they collected what they called a discarded bit of DNA. That could be something, you know, dug out of a trash can, and were able to confirm, hey, this looks like a match. And then that's what we understand led to the arrest.
Well, Alex, we have to go back in time a little bit. Here's FBI agent Marcus Knudsen in Sacramento yesterday talking about what it was like during those times in the 70s and 80s when the Golden State Killer was on this violent crime spree.
If you lived in Sacramento during that time frame, you have a story of what happened and where you were and what was going on. During that time frame, everybody was in fear. We had people sleeping with shotguns. We had people purchasing dogs. People were concerned.
Alex, remind us of the brutality of the Golden State Killer, also known as the East Area Rapist. What kinds of crimes did he commit? And what was it like in California at the time?
Well, I think it's been described as somewhat of like a siege of terror, particularly in the eastern part of Sacramento, where a lot of these rapes were occurring with some frequency. The general MO of the suspect was, you know, he would stalk a house, break in the middle of the night, usually by prying open, crawling through a window, and tie up the, you know, if it's a couple, the female and male together, separate them and basically put, he would pile dishes on top of the back of some of the male victims and say, if I hear one of these dishes crack, you know, if I hear him fall, then I'm going to kill you both. That was how he kind of was able to subdue one person while he then, you know, raped the woman. And in Sacramento, he wasn't known for killing a lot of his victims until a couple sort of saw him out on the street in 1978. But that wasn't during one of his burglaries. He shot them as they ran away, investigators think to try to keep himself from being identified. As his crimes progressed, he was more likely to kill in order to not leave witnesses.
Alex, what do we know about the suspect, Joseph James D'Angelo? One remarkable fact that's come out is that he was twice employed as a police officer in different communities in California. Do we know anything about his record as a cop and whether he used that position to help in his crimes?
Yeah, I mean, he was a cop throughout the 1970s, or the latter part of them anyway. He spent 3 years initially in a small central California town called Exeter. And during that time, from 1973 to 1976, there was in the area a spree of crimes that became attributed to the Visalia ransacker. And it's thought that some of those crimes may be attributed to the same suspect. In 1976, he changed jobs. He moved up to just north of Sacramento and was a police officer with the city of Auburn. And he was there from 1976 to 1979. In 1979, he was fired after being charged with shoplifting a hammer and dog repellent. And it's unclear whether either of those tools would have been used in any of the crimes, but that's something that investigators are looking into right now. Was he actually... You know, was he caught stealing something to be able to advance his interests in this, crime spree? He was absolutely, if it's true that all of these crimes that are attributed to in Sacramento, what they knew as the East Area Rapist, if it was all him, then he was committing these crimes for years as he was a police officer with the city of Auburn.
And Alex, just before we go, what's next for the suspect here in terms of court appearances or further investigation?
Well, so far, there have been four murder charges filed against D'Angelo. And, you know, there's 12 murders that are attributed to his crime spree. So we're going to see a lot more charges coming together. Right now, they don't even know exactly where he's going to be tried. These crimes occurred in 10 counties throughout California, 10 potential venues, and they're trying to work out exactly where a trial will be held.
Alex Emsley, criminal justice reporter for KQED, a remarkable case. Alex, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us this hour on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. The suspect in the deadly van rampage in Toronto earlier this week has been charged with first-degree murder for the deaths of 10 people. Alec Manassian is accused of committing those murders by mowing people down on a nearly 2-mile stretch of crowded sidewalks. Toronto police are still looking for motives here, including looking at Manassian's social media posts.
The accused is alleged to have posted a cryptic message on Facebook minutes before he began driving the rented van.
Now, that cryptic message praised gunman Elliot Roger, who killed 6 people in Isla Vista, California in 2014. And it spoke of an incel rebellion. The word incel comes from the phrase involuntary celibacy. And it's an identifier for a mostly online community of misogynist men. Jack Smith IV is senior writer for Mike and host of the upcoming Facebook Watch show For the Record, which traces America's history of racism and sexism and extremism. Jack Smith, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me on today.
Well, Jack, investigators have not said that Alec Manassian's membership in the incel community that we're going to discuss was the motivator for this attack. But his apparent statements about incel have shined some light on it. Incel or involuntary celibacy, what can you tell us about the origins of this movement, what it is and who's attracted to it?
So to understand the origin of this term, and there's a whole lexicon of terms used in sort of the online misogyny community. But we have to understand the way that virulent misogyny and its various communities online see the world. So for most of us, looking at society and history, we understand that to one degree or another, sexism is real and sets up any number of barriers between women and their flourishing and success in their social success, their economic success. In the world of online men's rights activism, as it's sometimes called, they see this power dynamic inverted completely. It's not women who are the victims of sexism, but men, and through the and it's men who suffer the actual barriers, and that women use various kinds of conniving to set themselves up as sort of the true dominant class in our society. So
now you mentioned Jack, you mentioned men's rights and the men's rights community, something that people may have heard of online. Incel or involuntary celibacy is a subset of that?
Yeah, it's a part of sort of the cornucopia of identities in the men's rights movement. And specifically, it is men who believe that they have been deprived of intimacy, the women's intimacy, perhaps intentionally, and that deprivation, their inability to essentially have sex with women, has been an assault on their self-esteem, their sense of status, and consequently their self-worth, and then harbor an enormous amount of resentment towards women for that alleged disenfranchisement.
And there's a narrative threading through this, which you're alluding to, that says feminism, essentially, even modernity itself, has basically robbed men of their masculinity.
That's right. It's important to understand, you know, there's a funny relationship, and we can get to it later. There's a relationship between men's grievance and a lot of times what we see in white supremacy and white grievance. So we are obviously living through a time when women are increasingly demanding equity and equality in various spaces of life. So we see this, for example, in the Me Too movement. The quote, men's rights movement is a sort of reactionary backlash to this demand, the same way that every time throughout history we see a demand for civil rights for, say, people of color, there is a commensatory white backlash. So on the one hand, it is misogyny as anyone on the street understands misogyny. But on the other hand, it's also a very specific political identity that provides an entire critique of the world to those who adhere to it.
And how large is this community? And let's confine it to the incel community online. Do we have a sense of how big these groups are?
So these things are pretty hard to talk about, but we can talk in some vague numbers. You know, I get the same question a lot about the so-called alt-right. How big is it? Some incel communities have reached maybe 20 to 40,000 members before they are often shut down from sites like, for example, Reddit, where many forums exist to support men who feel so aggrieved by feminism and alleged anti-male sentiment. But it's not really clear the broad extent to which this is felt, because one of the only ways it comes to the fore and we experience it is in moments like Tuesday's van attack, which is only one of many examples of extreme violence and mass killing related to men's reactionary misogynist identity.
Right. So I want to talk about that nexus with violence, because we have to be careful to draw a line here. The men's rights community online might be large, and the incel community, it's hard to say. Being a misogynist or feeling like you've lost your masculinity isn't illegal. Violence definitely is illegal. And Alec Manassian, allegedly in one of his posts, praises someone he calls Supreme Gentleman Elliot Rodger. Now, I mentioned Elliot Rodger as the perpetrator of a mass attack in California in 2014. Is he some kind of patron saint of a violent wing of the incel community?
So for the more nihilistic leanings of the community, because you're right, there is a line to be drawn, right? Because a lot of times the incel community is about providing tips on how to navigate this alleged female-dominated world that has so oppressed these men. But oftentimes there's this darker, very, very dark side to men's reaction, which is sort of a total nihilism. you know, the struggle for men's rights is seen as a Darwinian struggle over status and resources with women. And there are some misogynists who get to the point at which they feel that there's nothing to be done and the game is lost. Elliot Rodger, who killed, I believe it was, 6 people in Isla Vista, California a few years ago, went on incredible misogynist rants using this kind of vocabulary on YouTube at length. He wrote an entire manifesto in which he essentially said, I've been robbed of my confidence and my masculinity by women who deny me and seek out alpha males, and sort of that he's been led to this act of ultimate and nihilist and compensatory revenge, which is not to say that these ideologies always end there, but they most certainly sometimes do. And since then, by the way, I'll mention real quick that the Toronto van attacker was not the only one to praise Elliot Rodger. Nicholas Cruz, the Parkland shooter, also went to great lengths to praise Elliot. At least once commented online that Elliot Rodger will never be forgotten, etc.
So investigators are looking now into the postings in the background of Alec Manassian as they try to piece together motives for this horrific crime in Toronto. And Jack Smith, it's giving us a window, whether it's the cause or not, it's giving us a window into this disturbing world of misogyny and sometimes violent misogyny. Jack Smith IV, senior writer and correspondent for Mike. Thanks, Jack.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.